going to be presenting, as Catherine said, on the health information needs of mothers with disabilities. The principal investigator of the study actually is Mary Mason, who is a resident scholar at the Women's Studies Center at Brandeis University. And I worked with her on this study over the last several years. And we did this study because of both our own experiences as mothers with disabilities, because of what we heard from other mothers with disabilities about the whole process of bearing children, raising children, trying to find support to do all of that, and the many difficulties that women have, including finding information, accurate information about every aspect of bearing and raising children. It was a broad study. It was focused on a lot more than just information needs. It was sort of a general inquiry into women's experiences of pregnancy and childbirth and some of the challenges women faced. It focused on what were women's experiences as healthcare providers and what strategies and resources did women use. So it was a very broad study, but the whole question of information really kind of left out as we received the data. The recruitment method was very simple. Snowball sampling, outreach through meetings, letters, and visitors. We ended up with a sample of about 26 women with a variety of different kinds of disabled conditions, some of which I'd never heard of. spinal cord injury, cerebral palsy. We had four women with those, four women with polio, three with cirrhosis. Other disabilities included Friedreich's ataxia, spina bifida, central cord disease, a form of dwarfism, other conditions. But actually, two women who were visually impaired and one who had a superficial difference somehow found their way into the study. I'm actually not presenting data on there, but their issues were somewhat similar as well. We did individual interviews, and you didn't use the grounded theory approach when we analyzed the data. So, and the questions we asked were sort of what you'd expect us to ask. What motivated you to have children? Now, in this room, the answer to that, I think, is fairly obvious. However, it's often, unfortunately, not obvious to the average person why someone with physical difficulties, disabilities, would want to go through the process of having kids. In fact, one of the women we interviewed, when she first brought the issue up to her obstetrician, said, the doctor said, why? So it's not obvious to other people as it is to us. We thought it was something that was important to kind of flesh it out for people and make it real. So, do you have any concerns about your pregnancy? Did you have any concerns about your pregnancy? And how did your partner or yourself respond? Did your family respond? And of course, what was your experience with healthcare providers? Were they supportive? Were they not? We'll get into a little bit more about that later. And then how did you manage the tasks of parenting physically? Did you use any adaptive equipment? And do you see any difference between the physical tasks of mothering and being a mother? Since the number of women with disabilities may have difficulty in actually performing some of the manual tasks that generally are mothers and fathers. We wanted to see if women saw a difference between that and their role as a mother. So, the limitations, of course, are the primary limitation is really that this is a self-selected group. So, you may tend to get women who feel relatively good about their experience in parenting, and that may create some potential bias. So, can I still be a mom? This was the question on the minds of all of the women that we talked with who had acquired disabilities as adults. In fact, this quote comes from Cindy Ableman. Cindy, that's her real name. For the most part, we use pseudonyms, but some of the women really wanted us to use their real names, and Cindy wanted us to use her real name. And in fact, this comes from her one of her initial conversations with her doctors after she acquired her spinal cord injury. And in fact, the full quote is, "Just tell me one thing. Can I still be a mom?" Get choked up, right? Like that. And when the doctor said yes, she said, "Then I can do this." That's how much it meant to her. So, So, anyway, but this question also was one on the minds of women who had early onset or congenital disabilities. So, for example, Lori, a mother with cerebral palsy, said, we went in for the appointment just before we got to get pregnant, and we asked my OBGYN, is there going to be a problem getting pregnant? And pretty much all of the women who had congenital or early onset disabilities asked similar sorts of questions to their doctors. Something I find sort of interesting about this is that it certainly makes sense that if you're actually thinking about getting pregnant, you would raise this question. But I find it sort of interesting that they hadn't raised it at some point earlier in their lives. You know, I think about adolescents. Adolescents start thinking about these sorts of things. You get teenage girls. And none of them apparently had asked this question before they actually were considering getting pregnant. So, of course, they wanted to know about the impact of the pregnancy on the disability. And so this was Julie, a mom of Friedrich's ataxia. And she said, we went to a genetic counselor to make sure whether we could have problems with the disease I have to have a baby. Friedrich's ataxia is a genetic autosomal recessive condition that causes sort of degeneration of the muscles, including the heart muscle. And so there was concern about whether the pregnancy would be too difficult, would cause problems with her heart. Fortunately, it didn't. But of course, she wanted to inquire about that. A lot of women who had genetic conditions did go to genetic counselors, and most of them did not do amnio, which is kind of interesting. But a couple of them had a baby before amnio was prevalent, so that may explain it in part. But they did tend to go to genetic counselors, and they did seem to want to know sort of what the chances were and what the impact might be. But they all they all sort of had this attitude. They all sort of said, we knew we would be able to handle whatever was going to come our way. And another woman with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis said, and I thought, I'm not so bad. If a kid ends up like me, yeah. this mom, I think, said it very nicely. She said, I feel that I've had a good life, and I know how to give my child a good life, too. And that's regardless of whether or not the child has a disability. I think some of the moms felt that if their child did have a disability, they would be uniquely situated to really help them have a good life, because they knew sort of what it meant to have a disability and how to make it all work. This particular woman was a very, very accomplished woman. She had a job in the corporate world and earning six figures and has done very well. And so I think she felt a great deal of confidence in her ability to give a similar kind of life to her children. Women were, of course, interested or concerned about the impact of the disability on the pregnancy. And this was a really challenging thing for a lot of the women. And this one, I think, said it very nicely. She said, I felt like I was unique in some ways, and I wish they, the medical professionals, had sort of treated that uniqueness a little like, wow, this is kind of different. And also to sort of really make an effort to incorporate what they knew about her disability into the actual treatment, which didn't actually happen as much as one might hope. They got ignored a lot. The police got ignored a lot. So, something that came up a lot, you won't be surprised here, is that women had a lot of cesareans, and many of them questionably necessary. Of course, you know, that happens in general. About a third of women these days have cesareans, and some of those may not be necessary. And about half of women in our samples had cesareans. And this woman, she had a cesarean, and in a subsequent conversation with the doctor said, you know, you could have had a child vaginally. She had polio, and my understanding is that really with polio, there aren't necessarily any reasons that you'd be required to have a cesarean. But a lot of moms did, but they questioned it sort of after the fact. So they would have liked to have had more information about up front, about whether they really needed a cesarean or whether it was an unnecessary procedure. Anesthesia, this doesn't get discussed much, but it's actually really important. And again, there were some issues with the information we got around about this. This is again another mom with polio, and she said, There was one anesthesiologist that said he would do it, in Durham, if I needed it. And another one that said, no way. That she probably could have had an endo. But there was not really good information about among the anesthesiologists about whether she could have done it or not. And there's another woman in the sample who had spina bifida, and she was told she could have an epidural. And in fact, some women with spina bifida haven't essentially given epidurals, mostly in England. Given how painful childbirth can be, having all options on the table is really important. So, where did women get the information that they did get? Well, some of them got it from professionals, the genetic counselors, the information about the likelihood of passing on a disability and information about their options. One thing that was kind of good was that it seemed as though the genetic counselors that these particular women dealt with were pretty unbiased in their presentation of the facts. None of the women reported to us that the genetic counselors painted a dark picture of disability. Perhaps that was because they were dealing with someone with a disability who knew more about living with it than they did. I don't know. That's pure speculation on my part. But for the most part, it seemed as though the counselors were very even-handed in their presentation of disability and the options that women had in terms of using a donor egg and all those kinds of things. Sources of information, OBGYN. OBGYNs were usually correct about the woman's ability to get pregnant. That much they seemed to have down and to have gotten right. They were mostly right about that. There was one woman who had polycystic ovaries, and she was told she couldn't get pregnant. But that didn't really have anything to do with her disability. That was just a totally separate condition that she just happened to have. And in fact, the doctor was wrong when she did get pregnant, much to her surprise. Unfortunately, and this won't be any surprise to the folks in this room, the doctors were often not knowledgeable about the impact of the disability on pregnancy, or vice versa. It was all just sort of unknown territories a lot of times. And they often weren't aware of the level of attention needed during the childbirth process. There were a couple of women with spinal cord injuries whose babies, who were not really closely monitored during the process of childbirth, and who sort of ended up in a situation where everybody needed alarm bells and rushing into the room all of a sudden because no one realized how quickly the pregnancy had progressed because no one was really keeping close track. So clearly the OBGYNs and the nurses, unfortunately, too, in these situations as well, were not really aware of kind of the level of attention needed. So caregiving equipment and services. Most women just figured it out on their own. That's true. Most women did not get information about caregiving equipment and services. They just sort of jerry-rigged a lot of things. they used baby carriages, they used the car seats, they used whatever they could figure out to use. They changed babies on the couch, they changed babies on the bed. They jerry-rigged a lot of things. Three women, though, and I don't know if there's anyone here from Through the Looking Glass, but three women did mention Through the Looking Glass. And that was totally unprompted. They bought that as themselves. Through the Looking Glass, for those of you who might not know, is an organization here in Berkeley, California, that provides a lot of information about adaptive equipment for parenting, a lot of support and other kinds of information about parenting to parents with disabilities. It has actually a National Research Center funded by NIDER, I believe, on the topic. So it was kind of encouraging that Through the Looking Glass was mentioned. One woman did mention the state rehab agency because they had modified her home. They had given her a stair climber. And another woman, one woman did mention, I didn't want to mention it, was the independent living centers. They were mostly absent from this picture. But one woman did call and was told that the state PTA program did not provide help with child care or something. Which is true. it's not one of the covered services. There may be some kind of ways to have the PTA help them here and there with various tasks, but it's not covered, and that's what she thought was interesting was that one of the important sources of information for living was the diagnosis phase groups. I couldn't come up with a better term for them than that. If anyone has one, please let me know. The MS Society, United Cerebral Palsy, similar kinds of groups were very helpful for women and gave information about childbirth and also were a source of finding other women, a source of finding peers with disabilities who were either going through the same process or had gone through the same process. So that was actually a very important source of support for some of the women in the study. And I wasn't expecting that for some reason, but when you think about it, it makes sense. If you are not tied to the social service system and you have a particular kind of condition, it makes sense you go looking for people who have a similar condition. Mothers started their own peer support groups. We had some very proactive moms in the study, and a few of them did this. They started their own peer support groups. Then, and not surprisingly also, they turned to family. Some women had supportive families and some didn't. Those who did have supportive families certainly did turn to them for support. So, in summary, the findings. Most women proceeded with the pregnancy, childbirth, and caregiving despite paucity of information. And that was true regardless of whether the pregnancy was planned or not. Some of the women were just a very determined group of mothers. Most women who had a genetic condition, I should say, did seek out genetic counseling, but were comfortable with having a child with a disability. They just sort of wanted to know what their options were and what the future might look like. Healthcare professionals generally gave accurate information about the capacity for becoming pregnant, but were often ill-informed about other aspects of pregnancy and childbirth. And diagnosis-based groups were important sources of information and support. And of course, information and support from peers is critical. So what can we do to try to get some more information to women? And I know I'm speaking to the choir on this one, and everyone's, this has been a several times throughout the time. Educating healthcare professionals would certainly be an important place to start. And then also, since the diagnosis-based groups are involved to some extent in a way in getting the information out to them and reinforcing their capacity to do so, I think would be another use of strategy. I think it would also be good to broaden the base of organizations that provide information and support. I mean, you know, the maternal and child health programs are conspicuously absent here. The state maternal and child health programs. They tend to focus on women who have children with special needs rather than mothers with disabilities themselves. So somehow involving them, I think, could be useful, as well as involving the independent living centers, since they do so much else to promote independent living among women. It makes sense that they would also be involved in this. In addition, increasing state and local capacity to offer information about adaptive equipment. It's really good that the Little Black exists. But it's in California, and I think it would be really good to have those kinds of resources closer to home for a lot of women. And I know that in either Idaho or Iowa, one of those I states up there in the Midwest, their tech act actually wrote a really nice brochure or kind of informational piece on adaptive equipment and getting adaptive equipment for mothers. So I think local Tech Act programs could sort of try to get into the mix a little bit more and provide this information to the independent living centers or whomever. I think that would be an important step forward for moms and their kids with disabilities. Thank you very much.